Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So, today, House Democrats announced two articles of impeachment against President Trump, one for abusing his power and asking Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden, the other for obstructing Congress as lawmakers investigated by ordering key witnesses not to testify. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff explained why Democrats aren't fighting that in court and are urgently moving to bring a vote on the articles by Christmas.
The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election? Why not let him cheat just one more time? Why not let him have foreign help just one more time?
Let's bring in Colorado Congressman Joe Neguse. He's a Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, which worked overnight drafting these articles. And Congressman, your committee didn't bring a third article of impeachment, obstruction of justice, stemming from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Now, Mueller said he was unable to clear the president of obstruction, but left it to Congress to impeach or charge him. So did you fail Mueller and the American people by not doing that?
I don't think that's the case, Robin, but thank you for having me on. I would say this. I think there is clearly broad consensus within our Democratic caucus in the House that the president's actions really represents a continuing threat to the integrity of our elections and ultimately the sanctity of our democracy in terms of the undermining of our national security by virtue of the abuse of power that he engaged in, as well as the wholesale obstruction of Congress that he engaged in. And so that ultimately became the focus of the two articles that were introduced just today. As you'll see within the text of the articles, there is a pattern reflected in both the abuse of power article as well as the obstruction of Congress that references the realities of this president's conduct in terms of the pattern of conduct that he had engaged in. And that is to say, both actively inviting interference in the last presidential election and now soliciting foreign intervention into this one, as well as with respect to obstruction, the pattern of obstruction that the president had engaged in previously, for instance, the special counsel's investigation, and then, of course, obstructing Congress in its role in investigating the interference that this president has solicited into the next election.
And when you talk about the last election, there was President Trump, for instance, standing at a lectern and saying, Russia, if you're listening, how about getting those emails? Well, as you know, law professor Jonathan Turley, testifying last week, called by the Republicans, said that Democrats are abusing their power by rushing. Now, there haven't been firsthand witnesses like Mick Mulvaney, the president's chief of staff, who said publicly, yeah, there was a quid pro quo with Ukraine, get over it. Of course, Turley didn't acknowledge that you would have to have gone to court to fight the White House for refusing to hand over information. But given that call from Turley, you know, saying you're not finished here, you're not ready, do you feel you are ready?
I think we are ready. I think the evidence of the president's actions is overwhelming, and I think Chairman Schiff, during the inquiry that he conducted, compiled an incredible record of evidence that outlines the president's misconduct in this regard. And I had a chance to question Professor Turley, as you know, during the hearing that we held in front of the Judiciary Committee just last week. And he conceded during the hearing that, unlike President Nixon and President Clinton, this president has engaged in a wholesale obstruction of Congress, the likes of which we frankly have never seen before. As you know, the reason why we did not hear from people like Secretary Perry and several other witnesses, including the interim White House Chief of Staff, is because the president issued a directive essentially saying that he was going to not allow his administration to participate in this impeachment inquiry at all. That complete defiance of congressional oversight is unique and unprecedented. And you know, ultimately, we believe that it is grounds to proceed with the obstruction of Congress article that we have introduced.
Well, and the Republicans say this is a coup. They spoke as Democrats did today. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy saying Democrats are just removing an elected president just because you don't like President Trump. Further, he said some things distorting the Justice Department Inspector General report that came out yesterday, finding that there was no bias in the Russia investigation, no spying in the Trump campaign, although there were problems with some of the ways warrants were sought. But what do you do, given that the president has a bullhorn, a very big bullhorn, and he can say things like the IG report was vindicating when it wasn't? You know, there's a narrative that's building that you are undertaking a coup. How do you overcome that?
Well, it's a false narrative for the reasons that you stated, Robin. And I will just say it's regrettable that so many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle have refused to ultimately choose country over party. I think there are many of us that were hopeful that through this inquiry, our colleagues would ultimately view the facts objectively, review the evidence against the relevant legal and constitutional standards. And ultimately, if they did that, they would reach the same conclusion that we have, which is that ultimately this president clearly abused his power and obstructed Congress. And unfortunately, my colleagues have not done that yet. Obviously, as you know, we have several more steps in this process. We will mark up the articles and then potentially send those to the floor for the full House's consideration. So it remains to be seen whether there will, in fact, be some Republicans that will choose country over party. I'm hopeful that they will do so.
Congressman Joe Neguse, the Democrat from Colorado and member of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Survivors of yesterday's powerful volcanic eruption in New Zealand ran into the sea to escape the scalding steam and ash and emerged covered with burns. Those are some of the most horrific stories we've been hearing today after the White Island volcano erupted, killing at least six people. CNN international correspondent Will Ripley is in Tauranga, New Zealand, and joins us now on Skype. And Will, what more are you hearing about what happened yesterday?
It's really horrific, Tanya, to hear what volcanologists describe as just unsurvivable conditions for people who would have been actually inside the volcanic crater at the time of this blast. Because keep in mind, there are 47 people on the island, and volcano tourism is a huge draw here. So this cruise ship, this Royal Caribbean ship, the Ovation of the Sea, it offered this excursion where people pay, you know, almost $200 a pop to get on a small boat and go to White Island, which is visited by thousands of tourists every year. And they can hike on the island and actually go down into the crater and look over the edge. So if people were down there at the time of this blast, they would have experienced an explosion so powerful that boulders up to 3 feet across would have been shot up into the air. Smaller particles of rock would have been shot laterally, we're told, at sonic or even supersonic speeds. So that alone would have been fatal for people who were right up close. But people who were farther away, as you mentioned, they're enveloped in this, you know, impenetrable plume of volcanic ash, these toxic gases. If you breathe it in, it burns your lungs. And of course, if it touches your skin, well, we had first responders describing people with their skin falling off. That's how severe their burns were, which is why the hospital authorities are saying that for a lot of these people, these injuries may not be survivable.
Were people warned about this before?
This is the big question that we are asking, because we are told that there have been signs in recent weeks of increased activity at this particular volcano. They actually raised the alert level from 1 to 2, which the tour company says normally would not be an unacceptable risk level for these tourists. But we don't know what they were told. What we do know is that this was a popular excursion that people take. Thousands of people take it every year. And most of them would have assumed that if the tour company takes them to this island, that it's safe, that they believe it's safe. Yeah. There's some sort of a warning system to prevent this kind of thing from happening. And obviously that wasn't the case.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a popular island. It's a tourist destination. Many cruises come in and out of the area and tour this specific White Island volcano. People are still missing, as I understand it. What sort of effort is underway to find them?
We believe that there are 8 bodies that are sitting on the island covered in ash right now, but the conditions on the island are still too dangerous for rescuers to actually go in there and recover. But they flew drones overhead, and the description is that you can see the bodies just kind of lying there. And so these people who are missing, their families know what happened, but they don't have any closure until people can actually get on the island to recover them.
New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was praised for the way she handled the aftermath of the Christchurch mosque shootings back in March. Has she spoken about this, and how is she handling this disaster?
She's been on top of it, really, you know, within hours of the disaster happening. And in fact, she'll be making a visit to the site herself tomorrow, where she's expected to meet with some of the first responders, possibly some of the families of those affected. The first identified victim is actually a New Zealander, a tour guide who was there guiding people on the island. So this is a huge tragedy for New Zealand. And it also raises a lot of questions about the local economy here, because volcano tourism is a pillar of the economy. It's why cruise ships come here. But and I should mention, the company that actually operates these tours has an excellent safety record. Last year, they were voted one of the safest places in New Zealand to work. So it's not like this is the kind of thing that happens often. But obviously now there are going to be very serious questions raised about why people were allowed to not just go visit this island, but to hike into the volcanic crater, given the fact that it has a history of geothermal activity. And there have been eruptions there in the past. And even in recent weeks, they saw this uptick. Did they put tourism dollars ahead of people's lives? And what does that mean moving forward? Those are the really unanswered questions right now.
So many questions. And as you have said, so horrific. Thank you so much for your time. CNN international correspondent Will Ripley in New Zealand. Will, thanks again.
Thanks, Tanya.
What were the best albums, songs, and memorable moments from 2019? I'm Robin Hilton. Join NPR Music all this month as we look back at the past year, from Lil Nas X and Billie Eilish to Lizzo and Leonard Cohen. Listen on All Songs Considered from NPR with new episodes each week.
It's here and now. The Strokkr Geyser in Iceland's Haukadalur Valley is one of the world's most active, erupting every 10 minutes or so, sending plumes of steaming hot water high in the air.
That was cool.
We're here to see firsthand how climate change is impacting this tiny island nation and how they're fighting back with their natural resources. The geysers are propelled by underground magma, an intense heat source close to the Earth's surface. All over Iceland, you can spot steam rising from vents in the earth. At the geyser, streams of steaming hot water run by walkways that warn, don't touch.
Is it hot?
Yeah.
This is the heat source that Iceland's geothermal plants tap into to generate the power that heats water and homes. Then there's the sleekly modern Hellasheide plant sitting on a bleak black volcanic plain half an hour outside the capital Reykjavik. We're hearing the generators that power huge turbines as the underground water flows through them. One hint, you can smell the water.
That smell, is that the sulfur?
Yes, this is the hydrogen sulfur.
These plants are clean energy, but they do produce some carbon dioxide, and that's what's exciting at this plant. In a project called CarbFix, young scientists capturing that CO2 and injecting it into basalt rock. This is carbon capture and injection. It's been done before, but usually the CO2 eventually leaks out. Not here. We'll explain. It's a windy, rainy day, so in hard hats and protective gear, we take a car tour of the grounds with Carrie Helgeson, the project's manager.
This is the little one, yes, our Arctic fox, yes.
He's gesturing at what looks like a moonscape and a small prototype carbon injection station made in Switzerland. They've got a more advanced version, that's what we're heading for. Also with us, geoscientist Sandra Snæbjørnsdóttir, who agrees the building looks like an outhouse.
Yes, so they call it the Arctic fox, but we call it tiny.
So this captures 50 tons a year?
That is Andre Magnusson, Iceland's premier environmentalist. He's also a poet, a cultural icon. He's thrilled by the work here, but points out that this Swiss station is tiny in many ways.
To get 1,000 gigatons out of the atmosphere, we have to scale this up not 1 million times, but 1 billion times.
If you fly to Europe and back, it will take this unit about a week to offset your emissions.
Which, again, is why there's so much excitement around the world about what we're about to see. The newer CarbFix injection wells, they can capture 1,000 times more emissions. And if they run at that capacity, Andre says with a wry smile,
then we have solved the climate crisis.
We ask scientist Carrie Helgeson about the rocks we're walking on.
This black pebbled rock beach, this is all the volcanic rock?
This is all volcanic rock, yeah. So these are the types of rock that we're using. If you pick one up, for example, you can see that it's like a Swiss cheese. There's a lot of porosity in it, a lot of holes. So this is also what we have underground. This is what gives us the opportunity to put all this CO2 underground.
Carrie explains to us the basics of carbon injection strategy.
You need three things in order for this particular method to work. You need a lot of water, or it can be seawater. You need favorable rock formations, and you need a stream of CO2.
So, we get back in the car. It's all simple, except for one thing.
We are lacking the stream of CO2.
In other words, the process works, but these geothermal plants, again, are clean. And as Carrie tells Andre, his team is thirsty for more polluting emissions to inject into the rock.
We need to catch it where it flows from the chimneys. So
I've been talking to young people, and I tell them that if they go into your profession, you're only three of you guys now in the phone book. It's like if I went into computers before the internet. If we're going to scale this up a million times, that means millions of jobs that will be created.
And it will be scaled up. We know it's going to be scaled up. The question is, will it be scaled up enough?
If we don't scale it up, we're dead.
I'm not cheering up.
We're past the point in which we can simply just reduce our emissions.
So in the future, you will have like capturing equipment on chimneys of the world, and you might have like gas ships sailing to harbors where it will be pumped down with maybe seawater.
Finally, we see the buildings covering the wells. Rising from the fog in front of us are these igloos. They look like geodesic domes in the middle of this black volcanic rock expanse.
We have retrofitted 2 out of these 17 wells to be able to receive gas. Now, this is our main injection well, which we call HN16. Okay. It's a very good well. One of my favorites.
Oh, okay. Inside, a small room filled with large metal tubing.
So we have the geodesic dome above us now, around us, and inside we have this technology where... Just talk to us for a second now, the difference between this kind of work and work that we know about. So we saw the basalt rock that's formed by the volcanoes. It's different from sedimentary rock, where we know also there's been some injection. What's the difference?
The difference between basalts and sedimentary rocks are the reactivity of these rocks. So sedimentary rocks may originate from volcanics to begin with. Then, you know, the softer material gets washed away and we have mostly silica left. This type of rock is not very reactive, but the rocks that we have here surrounding us, they contain about 25% of the metals that we need to combine with the CO2, turn it into stone. Instead of injecting just gas, which can migrate up, we kill the buoyancy by dissolving the CO2 into the water.
I guess that's the main concern about carbon capture and injection that might then later escape and still be emissions. And you're saying this has proven, I mean, to prevent that.
Yeah, we dissolve the CO2 to kill the buoyancy, and this fluid has therefore the tendency to sink. But then with time, this fluid reacts with the rock, releases the metals that it needs to turn the CO2 into stone.
Sandra walks around the small room filled with pipes and valve wheels. One part looks like a ship periscope. One pipe bores through the floor and deep into the ground below.
So the injection is going on here. This is the well. And this well reaches 2,000 meters down. Through this pipe comes just regular water from the power plant, which we flow on the outside of a stainless steel pipe, which is this one. This one reaches down to about 800 meters. Within that pipe, we have the gas saturated fluid.
On one windowsill, there's a piece of injected rock.
This is what it looks like. So this is a core that we retrieved from 500 meters depth.
Let's just describe it. It looks like a tube of
rock. It's like a
rock.
Sponge, yeah.
And it has like speckles on it, like maybe you'd see on a black countertop with white speckles. What exactly is that we're looking at?
So the dark rock is just the basaltic rock. But then we have these white precipitates that are actually CO2 turned into stone.
That's the CO2 right there,
this
the dots.
This is mineralized CO2.
Well, and Andre, as you say, just scale that up.
Actually, this plant, the problem with this plant is actually getting access to CO2. But if you have like a coal-fired power plant and you can fill a tank ship, then the hard work is over. And then you could pump that into basalt anywhere where you have that in the world. The 20th century made infrastructure. It made like sewage systems. It made road systems. So the infrastructure that the 21st century will make and has to be as big as sewage or road systems is CO2 removal.
And you're both nodding.
Yeah, I mean, around the world, industries and coal-emitting power plants will have to see if this method makes sense at their particular site. If not, then we can start thinking about transporting it to favorable rock formations, such as in Iceland.
This seems to be a real plausible solution. If this is scaled up properly, and the price of it also seems to be favorable, this can be one of the major contributors.
You know, up until now, it has been much cheaper just to do nothing than to do something about your emissions. But this seems to be changing, and this is predicted to change even more, that it will become more costly to emit the CO2 than to capture your emissions.
Taxes and things like that would force the industry to do it.
In Europe, we have the European trading scheme where you can buy carbon quotas.
It's like cap and trade.
So the prices of these quotas have been rising, and now it's actually approximately the same price of doing this as for doing nothing.
We are really feeling it now that the industry is actually coming to us and asking about this process. So we can see the system is actually working.
Even though Iceland is perfect for this because the whole country is made of this rock, we can find big fields of basalt all over the world.
It lines the ocean floor, right?
It's actually the most common rock type on surface on Earth. So we have the know-how, and we have a lot of wells from the search of oil and lots of unused wells that could be used for injecting. So the infrastructure is somewhat in place already.
So in other words, the infrastructure for fracking and oil transport can be used to take emissions to where they can be injected into basalt rock. We leave you with the words of poet and environmentalist Andre Magnusson.
When I talk to young people, I tell them, all your working life will be about this. And the spark in Sandra's eyes, like when she's talking about what they have accomplished and how that can be scaled up, this generation will really feel that everywhere they go, there is a higher purpose. Imagine somebody going into the trash business and having that spark in their eyes. You know, so we thought the future would be more distortion of Facebook and screen time. I think it's the opposite. I think we're going much more into rock, earth, sky, you know, tangible. That's where we're going.
So, this week we're covering the climate crisis from a country on the front lines, Iceland. Tomorrow, the impact on fishing. For incredible pictures, go to hereandnow.org. Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. And less than an hour after House Democrats presented those two articles of impeachment against President Trump, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi returned to the microphone for another press conference, this time to announce that Democrats will support the Trump administration's revised NAFTA agreement with Mexico and Canada. It's now known as USMCA.
This is a day we've all been working to on the path to yes. We were in range for a while. But until we could cross a certain threshold of enforcement for our workers' rights, for environment, and for the prescription drug issue, as you know, they were three of the areas that we had put out there.
Let's bring in NPR's business correspondent, Jim Zeroli. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
So much going on today, but let's take on this. You know, Democrats have opposed parts of the new trade agreement. So what is this deal they've worked out with the White House? We just heard a little.
Well, you remember more than a year ago, the leaders of Canada and Mexico and President Trump sat down. They released this USMCA, which is supposed to be sort of like the new improved NAFTA. Mm-hmm. It had some things in it like, you know, improved access to Canadian dairy markets and stuff about the domestic content of autos. This in the intervening year, Democrats have sat down and tried to improve on it, and that today they said they're going to vote for the USMCA. And basically, you know, they were concerned about enforcement of labor environmental standards. This addresses, you know, that with new penalties for breaking the rules. It also has a new panel dispute system for resolving conflicts. It also eliminates protections for certain kinds of drugs, especially biologics, which are drugs produced from living organisms. And that was very important to Democrats because it affects healthcare costs. So essentially, Democrats took this deal and improved on it. They've gotten some concessions. The new text will be released today, unveiled again in Mexico City, and Congress will vote on it next week.
Well, you mentioned cars, and we know NAFTA was key for the auto industry because the supply chains cross the borders of all three countries. So how do automakers fare in this new deal?
Well, the original deal essentially said that more of the content of cars sold in North America has to be made here. It also says part of them have to be made in factories with an average wage of $16 an hour. This was meant to sort of drive factories back into Mexico, back into the United States from places like China. The Trump administration says this will reverse the loss of so many factory jobs. I think economists would say it will have an impact on the U.S. auto industry, but it will be modest. It also could lead to higher auto prices.
Well, and the International Monetary Fund says the impact on the whole U.S. economy could be negligible. But it's a win if lawmakers can agree on something. You have the AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka signaling he's willing to let it go forward. Why do you think Pelosi was? I mean, we're in the middle of the impeachment process. Was there a part of this wanting to have some yes?
Yeah, I think Democrats want to be able to answer the Republicans' charge that they're not doing anything but impeachment, you know, that they're so crazed with Trump hatred that they would miss an opportunity to do something for workers. So I think you saw the Democrats this morning, you know, announce articles of impeachment and then turn around and say, yes, we're agreeing to this. And in the process, handing President Trump a pretty significant political victory,
right,
sort of showing they can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Jim Zaroli, NPR's business correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
A giant rally this weekend in Hong Kong drew hundreds of thousands of people to the streets to mark 6 months of pro-democracy protests. This comes as President Trump says trade talks with China are moving right along, but a new round of U.S. sanctions could go into effect as soon as Sunday. For more on these two big stories, we're joined by Chow Chang Yan, executive editor of the South China Morning Post, an independent newspaper based in Hong Kong. He is currently in New York, where the paper is putting on its annual U.S.-China conference. And Chang Yan, as I mentioned, it's been more than 6 months since the political crisis began in opposition to an extradition bill that has since been dropped. Where does this protest movement stand now?
Well, the protest movement very much is still ongoing, and I don't see a quick end to this, because even after the government dropped the extradition bill, people's demand now has moved on to become, they first of all ask for an investigation against the police, alleged police brutality. And then more than that, they want to restart political reform, which were eventually lead to Hong Kong having this universal suffrage.
So the two top line demands, addressing police brutality and restart political reform, do you think there's any chance Beijing will meet those demands?
It is actually getting increasingly complicated, because 6 months ago when this first started, Beijing largely see this as a Hong Kong social problem, a local political problem. But now they increasingly see this as a proxy war between China and the U.S. So for some reason, Beijing is very convinced that the U.S. is behind all this. So because of that, I think the chance for Beijing to make a compromise is actually not very hopeful. So I think this unrest will go on for quite a while for various reasons. I think for Beijing and also for the Hong Kong government, then emphasize is first of all, the protesters have to cease to use violence. So this is the one thing they repeatedly stressed. You have to stop violence before we can talk. But for the protesters, they think that the government needs to make the first move. The government needs to show that people's voice has been heard and that they're going to take some initiative.
Can you talk more about the idea that the government feels that the U.S. is behind all of this? Can you say more?
Right. I think in the beginning, particularly for the Beijing, they always claim there are some so-called black hands behind it. But of course, they couldn't come up with a very convincing evidence to that. Some people from Beijing will say that they think the U.S. may not be directly behind this, but certainly they are playing the role of the aider and abettor, meaning that they are giving a lot of moral support to the protesters. And then they also think that the Western media so far have been so-called double standard in reporting this. A case they often use to compare is the Catalonia protests in Spain. But as things move on, particularly with this introduction of the Hong Kong Human Rights Act, then increasingly in Beijing, they think that this is basically become part of the leverage, part of the things that U.S. want to push the button on China. So they may not think U.S. is directly behind this organizing everything, but they think that U.S. is creating an environment for these protests to go on.
Let's talk a little bit about the media's role. You mentioned Western media. I'm curious, in the past, your publication, as well as many others, have received pressure to tone down coverage of politically sensitive issues. Has your publication faced any pressure from Beijing for its coverage of these protests right now?
I think that's largely a perception issue. Actually, we didn't get any pressure from the Beijing, but we do get a lot of pressure from both ends of the spectrum, no matter it's the anti-government or the so-called pro-establishment side. But the fact is that actually, if you go to read us, our report, all the information we use, we have verified those information. We have been sending reporters to the front line. We are trying to talk to both sides of the people. And also in our opinion section, you actually it's a very rare platform right now in Hong Kong where you can read opinions from both sides of the movement.
Let's turn to the trade war. Trump now says there's no deadline for an end to this trade war. How closely are people following this story in China, and what impact has it had on Hong Kong?
The trade war definitely is followed very closely in China, particularly this Sunday. Whether they can postpone the deadline is going to mean a lot to China's economy. The expectation is that they may be able to reach the kind of deal, the so-called phase one, and then for the both sides to have more time to continue the negotiation.
China announced on Friday that it would exempt some soybeans and pork from tariffs in the U.S. Who do people in Hong Kong blame for the effects of the trade war, China or the U.S.?
It's hard to say which side Hong Kong blame for the trade war. But basically, because of Hong Kong's role is like this middleman's role and the bridge connecting China with the rest of the world. So people are definitely worried about the trade war. The fact is actually the Hong Kong markets react more sensitively to the trade war news than to the protest news. This basically shows how important the trade war is to Hong Kong. I mean, to most Hong Kong business leaders and investors, what they want to see is a cease of this trade tension between China and the U.S. because both are critical to Hong Kong's economy.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about something else. The U.S. Congress has passed two bills recently that we hear that Beijing is not happy about. The first is the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which supports the protests in Hong Kong. And the other is the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, condemning the detention of Uyghurs in Western China. How are those efforts perceived in mainland China and really by protesters in Hong Kong? And really, are they going to make it more difficult for the U.S. and China to broker a trade deal?
Right. I think the two acts, first of all, in mainland China and in Hong Kong, they are perceived very differently. In mainland China, this is because of the rising nationalism sentiment in China. This is actually seen as another example, another evidence that the U.S. wanted to contain the rise of China and to push button on Beijing. I mean, in Hong Kong, particularly among the protesters, this is seen in a very much different light. They're actually seeing this as some kind of endorsement and support from Washington. So this basically gave them hope to keep this movement ongoing for a while. And as for the effect on trade war, I think the Beijing very much wanted to separate the two issues, because it's not in their interest to get the whole thing even more complicated. The trade war already involved a lot of very complicated detailed negotiation. But then they also have to take into consideration of the public reaction, public perception of the issue. So when these two act right now, when they are fueling to this nationalistic fire in China, it will actually reduce the room for the government to make compromise in order to get the trade deal done.
Yeah. Tell me more about this conference that you're at right now in New York.
Right. This is the first time SMP bringing our China conference to U.S. and to New York. This time we bring to U.S. because right now I think the China-U.S. relationship is probably the most critical relationship that will have bearing on a lot of things.
And I would assume that some of these issues that we talked about today will also come up possibly?
Oh, definitely. I think Hong Kong is on everybody's mind, and the trade talk, it will dominate this week's news.
That's Chao Chongyan, executive editor of the South China Morning Post. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks.
In 2015, several California public school districts broadened how they evaluate the quality of education. Instead of a narrow focus on math and language arts, they now also assess how safe people feel at school and whether they have a sense of belonging. David Freudberg with the public radio program Humankind reports on a San Francisco experiment in social and emotional learning.
The aim of the Millennium School in San Francisco is to develop well-rounded students, academically accomplished for sure, but also competent in the skills that help people relate sensitively to others and understand themselves.
It's the aspect of education that is most frequently overlooked as we race to pile more curriculum and more materials and more test-taking and more measurement onto these teachers and these kids.
Jeff Snipes is one of the school's founders.
And so our point of view was, if you want healthy students, you have to create healthy teachers, and you have to create a relationship of trust between them.
Millennium operates a private school begun in 2016, attended by about 80 high-energy kids, grades 6 through 8. And last year expanded this concept into San Francisco's largest public middle school.
It's children honestly being themselves, being open, being human, talking to each other. If you can create smaller groups, talking to each other, listening to each other, the teacher embodying it and setting the example, I've been blown away with how fast it takes off.
The students need this.
Millennium School science teacher Lindsay Burke.
If you think about mental health and you think about our most vulnerable populations, they don't need more minutes of math and reading. They need more support. And I feel like this is one of the strongest ways that we can really support them and then support the teachers in supporting them.
Jeff Snipe says it all begins with a lot of internal reflection by students.
We ask some questions, you know, who are you? What do you like to do? What are you most afraid of? What kind of life do you want to live? How do you like interacting with other people? Do you have a sense of how you could provide some service in the world as you grow up? And by tapping into some of these inner questions, we then ask them how they would like to bring them out into the world.
Snipe says a key to social and emotional learning is the quality of personal relationships. How clearly do students communicate with each other, with their teachers and their parents? How do conflicts get addressed? This is an area where the school atmosphere at Millennium invites openness. Here's student Summer Williams.
The students just, if they have a problem that's going on and they don't want to talk to their parents or they just want to bring it up, they won't hesitate. They won't feel like they'll be ostracized or made fun of, or everyone's just there to support them. So if they're ever going through something rough, they can come out and say that. And if they're going through something happy, everyone else can help share their happiness, which I think is great.
But even with people who are sincerely trying to connect, disputes sometimes arise. Williams says the Millennium community handles them from a carefully considered framework.
If we have a conflict with a friend or a teacher or anyone, it could be a family member too, they've taught us how to tell them the facts first, then the story, like what happened from like a third person view maybe, and then the story we made up in our head, like how we might have warped what happened to fit a certain idea that we had, then our emotions, how we felt about the situations, our sensations, and then what like our part in the conflict was so that we can be aware of that.
Handling interpersonal conflict means developing a special set of life skills, especially at this age. Here's Millennium Middle School student Nevin Lalick.
It's not, you know, like a casual conversation. You really need to, like, think and you really need to listen about what's going on. And I myself, I believe that I am capable of that kind of thing. So for me, all I really need to do is focus.
Which relates to another aspect of Millennium's teaching philosophy, an attempt to strengthen students' capacity for contemplation, being able to pause, to quiet down, to regain perspective. Chris Baum serves as head of school.
The ability to witness yourself is one of the most important developmental markers for adolescence. Can you notice the patterns in your own thought? It's very hard to do at the beginning of adolescence. But as they get older, in 7th and 8th grade, it's absolutely possible if it's trained and modeled.
I've been blown away by the transformation of these students. There's an individual shift that happens, and the individual shift is they mature so much more quickly into really grounded human beings. Instead of looking outside for the answer or to see what's popular or to see what other people think, the students stop, get quiet, go inside, reflect, and see what do they think. And that internal grounding leads to a very different level of self-confidence. With that self-confidence, there's less drama, there's less meanness, there's less bullying, because they don't need to manipulate others to feel good about themselves. They feel good on the inside first.
Jeff Snipes, co-founder of Millennium School in San Francisco. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.